This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 24, Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. President Bush presses Congress to reauthorize the No Child Left Behind Act. After a 20-month trial, an Indonesian court clears Newmont Mining of pollution. And labor and prisoner rights groups demand an investigation into a program that may have exposed prisoners to cancer-causing chemicals. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The government of Ethiopia has blamed rebels backed by rival neighbor Eritrea for a raid on an oil field today, which claimed the lives of 74 workers. China's state-run energy company manages the oil field, and 9 Chinese nationals were killed along with 65 Ethiopian staffers. Ethiopia's military is reportedly in pursuit of gunmen who kidnapped survivors of the massacre. Eritrea has denied involvement in the attack. The incident comes amidst ongoing fears that Ethiopian involvement in the conflict in Somalia could escalate into a regional war in the Horn of Africa. Tamil Tiger rebels flying light aircraft bombed a key airbase in northern Sri Lanka early this morning, FSRN's Pania Manikavasagam reports.
Military officials said soldiers reacted quickly and forced one of the rebel airplanes to change course. Today's rebel air raid killed 6 soldiers and wounded another 13. This is the second air attack on government troops in a month and came amidst rumors that the government was preparing a major assault on rebels in the north. A rebel leader said today that the 2 aircraft involved in the raid returned safely after causing heavy damage to the main Palale air base. A few hours before the pre-dawn rebel air raid, 4 people were killed and another 33 were wounded in a roadside bus bomb blast near the northern town of Vaunia. More than 4,000 civilians have been killed in violence which escalated 18 months ago after the new government took power. A 2002 truce signed between the former government and the rebels now exists only on paper. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Punnaya Manikavasagam from Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
The armed wing of Hamas is declaring an end to its 5-month-old truce with Israel. The announcement comes after a weekend of deadly Israeli attacks in the Palestinian territories. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert will reportedly meet with his security team tomorrow to discuss a response. A U.S. Border Patrol agent in Arizona has been charged with first-degree murder for the shooting death of a Mexican migrant. Leslie Clark reports.
22-year-old Francisco Domingos Rivera of Puebla, Mexico, was shot last January soon after he crossed the border from Mexico. The Border Patrol said earlier that agent Nicholas Corbett fired in self-defense after Domingos Rivera threatened him with a rock, but Cochise County, Arizona officials say physical and other evidence corroborate eyewitness testimony that Corbett wasn't in immediate danger when he fired the fatal shot. Mexican President Felipe Calderon and the victim's family sharply criticized the incident. In addition to first-degree murder, Agent Corbett has also been charged with lesser crimes, including second-degree murder, manslaughter, and negligent homicide. A judge will determine later the severity of the crime and how to charge the agent. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
In Mexico City, the local legislature's vote to legalize first trimester abortions has generated political tension throughout the country. Vladimir Flores has more.
The Legislative Assembly of Mexico City is set to pass reforms to the local penal code that will, in effect, decriminalize abortions performed in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Groups for and against the measure have demonstrated outside of the local legislature's building for days in the lead-up to the vote. Pope Benedict XVI has called on the Catholic Church in Mexico to rally against the bill. Legislators from Mexico City's ruling PRD party say the Pope's public comments could act as a justification for the death threats that some of the bill's supporters have received in recent days. The protests on either side of the issue are expected to last into the afternoon in downtown Mexico City, where hundreds of police have been deployed. In Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Today is the 53rd birthday of death row prisoner and FSRN commentator Mumi Abu-Jamal. Friends and supporters will hold a birthday celebration despite discouragement from Philadelphia's Fraternal Order of Police. Dante Tosa reports from Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police has announced that 400 Philadelphia armed plainclothes officers will protest outside of Mumi Abu-Jamal's birthday celebration. Organizers say that the event had to be relocated from the Clef Club in North Philadelphia to the American Friends Service Committee Center on short notice due to weeks of open threats and harassment by the Fraternal Order of Police. Actor Danny Glover and poet Sonia Sanchez will speak at tonight's event. Other supporters of the event include Black Cops Against Police Brutality and the National Association of Black Police. The African-American journalist has been on the death row for the past 25 years for the murder of a white police officer. Supporters say Abu-Jamal never received a fair trial. Ori Lumumba of International Concern Family and Friends of Mumi Abu-Jamal.
This is a matter of what's right. You know, this man is innocent. We have the facts showing this man's innocent, showing the fact that he didn't have a fair trial. And, you know, they're still hell-bent on killing this man despite the evidence.
This case is on its last legal appeal, and the oral argument is set for May 17th. From Philadelphia, this is Dante Toza.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A House panel is investigating a military practice of falsifying service member deaths. The committee looked into two cases, one being the capture and release of Army Private Jessica Lynch. The other is of the death of Army Ranger Specialist Patrick Tillman in Afghanistan. In Tillman's case, the Army said he died protecting his fellow soldiers from attack, although that wasn't the case. Representative Bruce Braley, Democrat from Iowa, questioned Army Specialist Brian O'Neill, who was with Tillman when he was killed.
Did Corporal Tillman shield you from enemy rounds at any time?
Negative, sir.
This version of the statement also says you, quote, engaged the enemy very successfully, end quote, that the enemy moved most of their attention to your position, which, quote, drew a lot of fire from them. Did you write these sentences claiming that you were engaged with the enemy?
No, sir.
Do you know who made the changes to your statement to make it appear as if you were receiving fire from the enemy rather than from your own platoon?
No, sir.
Tillman died from so-called friendly fire by the weapon of one of his fellow servicemen. The Army changed the wording of the statement O'Neill wrote, but the Department of Defense Inspector General was not able to determine who in the Pentagon changed the content. President Bush urged Congress to quickly reauthorize No Child Left Behind. Congress intends to do so, but the act might look different than it does now. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
With the backdrop of a charter school in Harlem, President Bush touted what he calls the success of No Child Left Behind. Highlighting NCLB as his domestic agenda priority, he is urging Congress to reauthorize the federal education policy before it expires this year. But Congress is taking its time. They're holding hearing after hearing to explore the policy. And what Congress already knows is that NCLB is receiving mixed reviews. They know that it's underfunded by $40 billion, and they know the school dropout rates are not improving. John Podesta is with the Center for American Progress. His outlook is dire.
Simply put, I think we're headed as a nation towards a significant erosion of our economic well-being and our way of life unless we find more effective ways to keep our kids in school and increase their ability to compete with others in a turbulent, globalized economy.
Podesta and other education analysts say grades 6 through 12 are neglected. They receive fewer resources as much of the education attention is focused on early start in elementary school and then again on higher education in the form of Pell Grants and financial aid. Bob Weiss is the former governor of West Virginia and current president of Alliance for Excellent Education.
If this is an air graph from here to here, is $18 billion, which is what the federal government spends for pre-K to grade 6. Let me move over here to higher education, post-secondary. This is about $16 billion. And so that's 18 and 16. So what do we spend for middle and high schools? About 2.5 for middle schools and about 2.5 for high schools, or a total of $5 billion.
Dr. Robert Balfons with Johns Hopkins University says 15% of high schools have half of the nation's dropouts, affecting poor and urban schools mostly. But the question he asks is this.
What's the federal role?
Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, introduced legislation to address the dropout rate. It focuses resources and funding for middle and high schools. But the role of the federal government in education will likely spark heated debate in Washington this year with the expiration of No Child Left Behind. Currently, NCLB places a great deal of control in the federal government on education policy. President Bush wants the policy to stay as is. But states have complained that NCLB ties their hands. Republicans in Congress have drafted some preliminary legislation that would keep No Child Left Behind, but do away with the school accountability provisions. Democrats, who control Congress, are unsure of what NCLB will look like, but they say they will keep some sort of accountability. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer.
The accountability provisions of No Child Left Behind are positive, but I'm sure there are going to be considerations of the problems that have been raised with respect to the coterie of those who are tested, that is, who is tested, how they're tested, how are schools determined to be successful or failing?
The Democrats are looking at alternative methods beyond testing to track student progress. One idea is through growth models. But Democrats are taking their time. Legislation is not expected until late this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
An Indonesian court has cleared a U.S. mining executive and his company of polluting a bay in Sulawesi. Richard Ness, head of Newmont Mining's Indonesian subsidiary, faced a maximum 10-year sentence if found guilty. The 20-month trial began after local villagers said they had suffered tumors and skin diseases from toxic chemicals dumped into the water from the mine that was active from 1996 to 2006. But the judge decided that the waste from the now-defunct mine did not breach government safety standards. Rebecca Henschke reports from Indonesia, where the judgment was handed down.
Pollution charges against Newmont and Richard Ness cannot be proven, Chief Judge Ridwan Damanik told a packed courtroom. All charges against the company are being dropped, he added. For Richard Ness, the head of Newmont's Indonesian branch, it was a huge relief.
I'm extremely happy, I guess the word may even be thrilled, that we have been exonerated. A real victory, not only for myself and the company, but the people of our communities really needed to hear this message coming out solidly right from the court. I had five people in early 2004 actually detained for 32 days. This clears their names out once and for all. It was very solid ruling that said not only was there no pollution, that the judges also said that the case should not have been in court. It proves business, investment, as well as the environment can coexist together.
Newmont was accused of dumping dangerous levels of both mercury and arsenic into the water of Buyat Bay in Sulawesi, making villagers very sick. During the course of the trial, the defense presented several studies, including a health report backed by the World Health Organization, that found no links between the mine and health problems in the community. And Newmont has continually claimed that levels of toxins in the water were well within local and international safety standards. The evidence for the prosecution came largely from a police investigation, which the judge rejected as incomplete. Community groups and environmentalists were bitterly disappointed. Hundreds of residents who live near the now-defunct mine staged a demonstration outside the court. Jen Smith, the local representative of the environmental group Jatam, says the people who have suffered health problems because of the mine's pollution are deeply hurt and extremely disappointed at the verdict. In Jakarta, leading environmentalist group Wali is dismayed at the judge's decision and says key evidence from the local police was ignored. Researcher P. Rajasthariga says the report by local health researchers, though endorsed by the World Health Organization, should not have been admitted as evidence.
Because WHO report is not environmental report or environmental study. The court should not use this. WHO studies, health studies, only on Minamata disease. There is enough report saying that Newmont has polluted the bay. Court reject to use this. The court released Newmont because of the technical, the procedural reasons, not because of the substance.
Sariga says the prosecution was limited by the judge's refusal to consider the police report as evidence and claims the verdict relied too heavily on scientific reports funded by Newmont. But the not guilty verdict has been warmly welcomed by foreign investors in Indonesia. Newmont ran an intense public relations campaign in the months leading up to the trial, placing large advertisements in the local media and hiring numerous scientists and doctors to speak out in the company's defence. President Bush even raised the case with the Indonesian president when he visited last November. At the same time, the CEO of the US Chamber of Commerce, Thomas Donohue, was sending strong warnings to the Indonesian government about the case.
This system lacks clearly transparency, legal protection, the assurances that companies that would want to invest here in the future would require, that Indonesia should be very thoughtful about this and how this is handled, or it will be very, very expensive.
He said a defeat for Newmont could have deterred investors from putting their money in the mining sector, which has not seen fresh investment for years. But the verdict is a defeat for environmental activists who were hoping the case would send a message that Indonesia is serious about enforcing laws to protect the country's rapidly degrading environment. The prosecution plans to appeal the decision. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke of Radio 68H in Jakarta.
Labor and prisoner rights groups want a Senate committee to question the head of the Department of Justice about prison labor practices under the department's electronic waste recycling program in U.S. prisons. Prison guards and inmates say they've been exposed to cancer-causing chemicals, and the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's department has ignored complaints and done nothing about it. FSRN's Christina Anastat has more.
For 4 years, Leroy Smith supervised safety standards of the Federal Bureau of Prisons and its Unicor e-waste recycling program at Atwater Federal Prison in California. He says exposure to electronic waste has caused numerous health problems for prison guards and inmates.
On occasions, I get these sores that the doctors can't figure out where they're, why they're developing on me. And I've had sores on my stomach area, I've had sores on my back, on my shoulders. Currently on my face, I have a couple of lesions. People are coming down with tumors on the brain, blisters that just pop out and then all of a sudden they disappear, a few days later. Some of the lesions that are everlasting, some liver damage, kidney damage, respiratory damage. And also there's been loss of life on several inmates after they got out of prison because of their exposure to these toxics.
Atwater is one of 7 U.S. prisons that employs inmates to recycle electronic waste under the Department of Justice's Unicor program. Smith says he sent documents directly to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez showing guards and inmates are overexposed to chemicals like lead and cadmium, but got no response. Now prison guards and prisoner rights activists are calling for a full congressional hearing on the matter. They want the Senate Judiciary Committee, to which Attorney General Gonzalez reports, to investigate e-waste recycling in U.S. prisons. Aaron Schumann with the Prisoner Activist Resource Center says the Bush administration and Department of Justice are responsible for criminal acts.
The corporation that's doing this is a government-owned corporation operated under the authority of the Department of Justice. That means that Alberto Gonzalez, every year the Attorney General has been getting a report on conditions like this. The CEO of this corporation is the head of the Bureau of Prisons. So what we're saying is that the head of the Bureau of Prisons is responsible for the deaths and illnesses that are coming out as a result of this.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration did investigate Smith's complaints about the Atwater facility in 2005. The report stated that a number of workplace changes had been made that addressed Smith's concerns, but Maureen Kane, an organizer with the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, says that health and safety inspectors do not have adequate access to workplaces in prisons.
The Department of Justice is not doing their job in terms of enforcing workplace standards. Inmates do not have the same health and safety standards that workers in other fields do. The OSHA officials can't enter Unicor's recycling facility unannounced. They actually have to call in advance, and we've heard from prisoners that before OSHA visits, they actually clean up the factory floors quite a bit and kind of make a mock scene of what's really happening there.
That's why the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition last year campaigned for California's UC College system to adopt a socially responsible electronics purchasing policy. And earlier this month, UC administrators agreed to purchase electronics only from manufacturers that reclaim their products for recycling, and then do not either ship the electronics outside the U.S. or to U.S. prisons for recycling and disposal. Meanwhile, prison guards and inmates from Unicor recycling facilities are considering a class action lawsuit against the federal government for neglecting their rights to a safe workplace. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Christina Onnested.
Los Angeles officials have introduced a program to make it easier to deport gang members who don't have immigration documents. They say the program is intended to curb gang crime, but activists are calling the measure repressive. FSRN's Leilani Albano reports.
City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo and L.A. County District Attorney Steve Cooley say their new policy will see local authorities team up with federal immigration agents to identify gang members for deportation. The city attorney's office is establishing new protocols to allow the two entities to share information on gang members convicted of violating gang injunctions. At the same time, the district attorney is proposing a bill that makes it a felony for gang members who were previously deported to re-enter the country. District Attorney Steve Cooley believes the plan could decrease rates of gang violence, which has spiked in one part of the city.
We have, through our various studies and meetings and gatherings, and anecdotally, determined that these individuals are the biggest part of our crime here in Los Angeles County, particularly homicides and attempted murders.
Presently, there are injunctions in place against 50 gangs, which prohibit gang members from congregating. Those who violate gang injunctions normally receive jail sentences of 3 months to 1 year. But under the new measure, gang members without documentation could be facing deportation. Immigrant advocates fear the measure violates a longtime LAPD policy known as Special Order 40, which prohibits police officials from asking suspects and crime victims about their immigration status. In response, the city attorney's office stated that local authorities will only give federal officials the names of convicted gang members and not suspects of crimes. Organizers, however, are not satisfied. Alejandro is the program director for the Epiphany Project at Homies Unidos, a gang intervention program in Pico Union. He says deporting gang members will not make the streets safer, but will lead to more racial profiling and other police abuses against immigrants.
It doesn't change nothing. When you really talk about safe, you really got to reconsider, because there's a lot of cops that have that mentality or have something against gang members, and some undocumented people living around here dress like gang members, so they get harassed. So in my eyes, no, it doesn't make it any safer in that aspect of it.
Richard Estrada, who is executive director of Jovenes Incorporated, agrees.
This is treading on dangerous water here. Already we're being besieged. Immigrant communities are being besieged by the ICE, and people are in terror.
According to a 2005 study by the California Department of Justice, Los Angeles is home to 463 gangs with just over 39,000 members. Just over half of these gang members are Latino, an overwhelming number of whom are second-generation Mexican-American and Central American youth. Only two gangs, the MS-13 and 18th Street, are predominantly made up of immigrant members. Thus, the measure would seemingly threaten increased harassment of the entire city in pursuit of a tiny fraction of gang members without papers. Don White is a KPFK local station board member and lead organizer with CISPAS, or the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. He says that deportation will also have fatal consequences for Central American youth and others who are sent back home.
Often they are brutalized by the police and the military in their home countries. In Guatemala, there's a history of so-called purification, where youth who are living on the streets, who do not have a support network, are rounded up, and often bodies are found in rural areas where they're simply, you know, executed by the authorities.
Rather than throwing city resources into targeting Latino youth for deportation, Alejandro says funding should be going elsewhere.
Reconsider intervention and start pouring more money into intervention programs. Maybe start buying more equipment to remove tattoos and maybe have them come and see some of our success stories, because we have a lot of people that have come through our program and that actually have gotten jobs and have been felony free and have been working and have been productive citizens of society, have gotten off parole. And those are fruits that we have worked with, we have planted, and we have seen them grow.
For FSRN, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Today is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, and activities are taking place all over the world to remember the massacre of Armenians that took place in Turkey in 1915. Here in Los Angeles, the Armenian community held a march in Hollywood's Little Armenia to commemorate the event. FSRN's Tunde Sizwe Shimarenga was there.
Shame on Turkey! Shame on Turkey!
On April 24, 1915, between 250 to 300 Armenian leaders, writers, thinkers, and professionals in Constantinople, today known as Istanbul, were rounded up and killed. Later that day, some 5,000 Armenians were massacred in the streets. It was the beginning of a genocide carried out by the Committee for Union and Progress, known as the Young Turks, that would kill 1.5 million Armenians out of a total population of 2.5 million in what was then the Ottoman Empire, today known as Turkey. Fleeing the killing that continued into the next year, Armenians settled around the world, including Los Angeles, Glendale, Burbank, Montebello, and Hollywood, an area now designated as Little Armenia. Although there are still many survivors, most Armenians in America are the children or grandchildren of the survivors.
Our great-grandpas and grandmas and our parents' grandparents were part of it, so they passed it on to us.
A group of 16 and 17-year-olds at the march told me that Armenian schools in the area had been closed for the day to commemorate the event.
If our genocide was recognized the time it happened, the Jewish Holocaust wouldn't happen. Many lives wouldn't be lost. Turkey's very stubborn. I don't know what it's going to take to convince them that the genocide happened. The longer they don't admit it, the worse they'll look. They become liars, and at least the Germans, you know, admitted that the Holocaust happened.
The government of present-day Turkey fiercely opposes the description of the Armenian deaths as genocide, insisting that the Armenians were trapped in a complex, multi-front war, and that far fewer than 1.5 million died. According to John Evans, former U.S. ambassador to Armenia, the United States denies the genocide also, so as not to offend its NATO ally. In Hollywood's Little Armenia, this is Tunde Sizwe Shimarenga for FSRN.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.